Some designs don't change much. The paperclip, the Bic pen, the QWERTY keyboard layout, and even the PlayStation controller. Decades and sometimes even centuries pass, but these designs barely change at all. They're quintessential. Why do some designs last for decades while other seemingly better alternatives never catch on? This exact question was asked by Technology Connections in his video about the Sunbeam toaster. Check it out.
You begin by inserting your bread slices into the slots and then... it what? Did that? The bread. It just went down on its own.
All you do is place the bread in the toaster. The bread automatically descends down, and then it comes back up a few minutes later at the perfect level of doneness.
This is how all toasters should work.
So why don't all toasters work this way? Why isn't the Sunbeam toaster the quintessential toaster design that we all know about? In order for something to become a quintessential design, it has to address at least 5 key points. The first thing is that it needs to be a high-quality, reliable object. I would say that the Sunbeam toaster accomplishes that. Let's look at the second point, though. It needs to be high scale and very prevalent, really popular. Quintessential designs are usually made in the millions or even billions. It's extremely successful and prevalent. It sets the standard. It just sort of becomes ubiquitous and expected. You're unlikely to be able to sell millions of Sunbeam toasters, though. First of all, the toaster costs like $23 in 1949, which was something like 1/3 of a week's salary at the time. And even though it's relatively simple, the Sunbeam toaster is still a lot more complex to assemble than other toasters. Every part that you add to a mechanical assembly is another potential point of failure. I've heard mixed reviews about the Sunbeam's reliability. Some say it's lasted them decades, others say it breaks constantly. It also only works with specific kinds of bread. Also, the biggest selling point about the Sunbeam is the fact that it's automatic. You just put the bread in the slots and it does all the work for you. But for most people, I'm not sure that's a big enough reason to shell out 1/3 of your weekly salary. There's value in pushing the lever down yourself. It adds just enough personal touch, and it also adds some tactile feedback that's kind of nice. The Sunbeam toaster is high quality enough to be a quintessential design, but it doesn't scale. There aren't enough people who are willing to spend so much money on a toaster, and the mechanical complexity makes it harder to manufacture millions of units effectively. Now, a regular toaster isn't perfect, but it's good enough. We learn to live in a world of imperfect things, just as we learn to live in a world of imperfect humans. The Sunbeam toaster is appealing to a very small audience, and that's great, that's okay. You shouldn't always cater to the masses. Look how excited Alec was about the toaster.
What is happening?
That's a special thing, and the Sunbeam is still a great design, but it isn't quintessential. Designing the process of how something is made is just as important as the design of the object itself. The paperclip is a great example of this. This design is unbelievably effective, and the fact that 11 billion of them are sold every year is proof of that. But there actually are better paperclip designs out there. This paperclip design was patented over 30 years ago. It's much stronger and therefore can hold more papers than a standard paperclip. It doesn't deform as easily. So why isn't this the quintessential paperclip design? It comes down to large-scale production. The standard paperclip making process is insanely efficient. It's just a 4-inch wire bent 3 times using a beautifully simple machine. The standard paperclip we all know was never patented, but the process for making one was. You need a quintessential manufacturing process to support a quintessential design. In the manufacturing process, every extra step raises the price of the final product. Another way to obtain scale and quintessence is to leverage laws, patents, and copyrights in order to make sure that your design remains the dominant force in the market. This is the Maglite flashlight, commonly used by law enforcement. If you know anything about flashlights, you've definitely seen this, or maybe you've been an unfortunate soul on the other end of a police interrogation with one of them shining in your face. But most people haven't heard of Maglite's cousin, the Kell light. Now, the Kell light was made by a different company. It's actually the original design, and the Maglite came a few years later. Both designs are very similar to each other, though. Before Kell light, flashlights were fragile and undependable. The Kell light was made of durable aluminum, though. The sales team would literally hammer nails with the light to show how durable it was. A big part of Kell light's sales pitch was that you could hit suspects with the flashlight instead of using a standard police baton. Very effective use of police budget there. 2-for-1 deal. Maglite adopted a nearly identical design and sales pitch to Kell light. So why has Maglite been selling over 10 million flashlights every year since the 1980s, while Kell light is the original innovator, and it remains relatively unknown. So I'll tell you, but first, let's talk about Opera, the sponsor of today's video. It's a great browser that's completely customizable. Have you ever opened up 50 tabs and gotten completely lost and confused? Opera automatically groups tabs for you based on what you're doing so you can stay organized. It even has chats and messaging services right in your sidebar, which keeps your browsing experience nice and tidy. I connect WhatsApp, Telegram, Instagram, and YouTube Music without ever leaving my browser or going to a different tab. There's also a built-in screenshot feature called Snapshot, so you can quickly capture inspiration. And for the multitaskers, there's Workspaces. Keep your tabs organized for work or play. One click and you're in a whole new zone. The overall design and layout is super intuitive and clean, and even the transitions between the tabs just looks really great. With intuitive tab navigation, integrated messengers, awesome screenshot tools, and customizable workspaces, Opera is the browser that's got everything you need to seamlessly and intuitively browse the web. Thanks to Opera for sponsoring this video. Use my link below to download Opera today. Okay, so back to the video. Why has Maglite sold 300 million flashlights while Kellite, the original innovator, remains unknown? First, Maglite introduced an adjustable focus light beam, which was a significant innovation even though it sometimes created a big black hole in the middle of the beam. Despite its flaws, Maglite is still considered the quintessential flashlight design of the 20th century. But what truly distinguished them was its aggressive legal strategy. Because Maglite is a pretty good flashlight, many people tried to copy their design. From 1986 to 1989, Maglite spent $17 million on lawsuits to protect its designs. That was over three times its advertising budget. The real genius of their approach came after winning one lawsuit in the mid-80s against major retail chains like Sears and Kmart, who were selling imported copies of their design. As part of their settlement, Maglite required these stores to purchase 5 real Mag flashlights for every fake knockoff they sold, solidifying their market dominance. The founder, Tony Maglica, even sued his own stepsons when they tried to start their own flashlight company. They wanted to address the Maglite black hole issue. Even though they succeeded in improving the design, a jury awarded Maglica $1.2 million for lost business and damages due to his stepson's alleged theft of Maglite research. This put his stepsons out of business, and basically, Maglite just sued all the competition out of existence. Maglites also became standard issue police force equipment for decades, partly due to Tony Maglica's connections. He often rubbed shoulders with US Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr., which may have helped secure those big law enforcement contracts, although it's hard to say for sure. The fact that it was a decent flashlight for the time helped a lot too. You could hold it under your arm, allowing you to keep both hands free, which can be important as an officer. But I think the main reason the flashlight was successful with law enforcement is simply because it's really big and intimidating. If you're holding one of these things, you just feel really safe and in control. It's also very intimidating from the other end, but lawsuits can only hold off innovation for so long. Competitors eventually made a better product for a lower price. This flashlight is still used by law enforcement today, although they tend to opt for other brands that improved on its shortcomings. Maglite is a prime example of how intellectual property protection and strategic relationships can secure market dominance and establish a product as a quintessential design. All quintessential designs set new standards. In the realm of video games, design evolves quickly. If you look at the PlayStation 1 console versus the PlayStation 5, one looks like an early 90s novelty, as you'd expect, and the other looks like it was designed by architect Zaha Hadid. But if you look at gaming controllers, the layout of the buttons and the overall form factor really hasn't changed much. So why do consoles look and function completely different while the controllers have remained the same? Early designs were diverse, from the Sega SG-1000 with its blocky body to the Atari Jaguar doing whatever the heck that is. The real game changer was the 1986 Nintendo controller, which set a new standard. It had the directional pad on the left, menu buttons in the center, and action buttons on the right. This layout became the blueprint for future designs, establishing a template that major console controllers more or less follow to this day. But it was the PlayStation controller that added wings and depth to make the design more ergonomic. And then, in 1997, Sony introduced these two thumbsticks. They helped gamers more easily navigate 3D worlds that were becoming more common as video game graphics improved. This was the final addition to the modern controller as we know it today. The rise of the PlayStation controller also coincided with a surge in console sales of the PlayStation 2, the best-selling console of all time.
Sony PlayStation 2 will be the biggest thing to come along since TV was invented.
The controller naturally followed suit. Even the Xbox controller and the Switch controllers follow a similar pattern. How many other consumer electronics can say they have the same basic form factor even after 30 years? The list is pretty short. Now, that's not to say that other companies didn't try to improve the PlayStation controller. Nintendo's motion-controlled Wii Remote is the most well-known example, but it never really set a new standard. To be clear, it's not that the PlayStation controller is the best design. It definitely isn't, at least not for everything. It's not ideal for first-person shooter games. A mouse is actually a lot easier to aim with. And the Hitbox controller is arguably better for many fighting games. So why is it still the quintessential design? Well, when it comes to gaming controllers, tiny changes make a huge difference in how the device feels. You're making very precise inputs that need to be perfectly timed. Moving buttons even a millimeter or two completely changes the feel, because players are so used to pressing the same buttons over and over again for thousands of hours. It's a very constraining design problem. On top of that, people's hands come in all sorts of different sizes and shapes. Controller designs basically have to accommodate the smallest 5% of hands up to the largest 95%. So you need a design that people are used to, and it needs to be comfortable for people with giant hands, tiny hands, and everything in between. There's just not a lot of design flexibility. But probably the biggest reason is that it's just what gamers are used to now. You see this everywhere, by the way, even on your keyboard. The QWERTY keyboard layout is not the most effective or fastest way to type the English language. Other layouts, like the Dvorak, are arguably faster. The QWERTY keyboard was designed to fix a common problem with early typewriters. The type bars, these metal arms that hit the paper to print letters, would often jam if certain keys were pressed too close together. This setup helped typists to type smoothly without the machine constantly getting stuck. But keyboards don't have mechanical type bars anymore. The only reason why other keyboard layouts aren't used is simply because we're just used to the QWERTY keyboard layout now. It's the standard. It's not worth spending months learning how to type all over again just for a tiny improvement in speed. And it's the same thing with gaming controllers. For a new design to get adopted when one standard is deeply embedded, it can't just be a slight improvement. It needs to be way better to justify making the change. Eventually, a new controller design will set a new standard, but it's probably going to be a little while. Maybe we'll see a change with VR gaming, which has completely different design requirements. Now, up until this point, we've talked about quintessential designs that defined a category of products. But there's another level to all this. What about designs that completely change culture as we know it? Let's take a look at one of the most quintessential car designs in history, the Ford Model T. Just kidding, that's a Buick. This is the actual Model T. I mean, they look more or less the same, right? So what makes the Model T the quintessential car for its time and the Buick just another cool-looking vintage vehicle? Well, for starters, the Model T was less than half the price at $440. The Buick was $1,050. But the secret to its quintessence was in the design's extreme simplicity. The car was completely stripped down of any unnecessary elements. A modern car has over 30,000 parts and pieces. A Model T has about a third of that, just around 10,000 pieces. Ford's engineers did everything they could to simplify the design. They even placed the gas tank higher than the carburetor, allowing gravity to feed fuel directly into a valve. That way, you wouldn't need a fuel pump to siphon gas through the engine. They eliminated the fuel pump, just one less part to deal with. Even the engine and the transmission used the same lubricating oil. Every single component, down to the last bolt, had a specific purpose. Anything else was taken out. Now, this is important because the fewer parts there are, the less likely anything is to break. The car was incredibly reliable for its time, and even if it did need repairs, it was pretty easy to fix. With a few simple hand tools and a basic understanding of mechanics, you could keep a Model T running smoothly for decades, which some people still do even today. With the Model T, the only goal was to be faster than a horse or walking. No radio, no comfort, nothing else, not even safety.
There you go.
Rolled over a little bit, but nobody died.
Just simplicity and efficiency on all levels. The Model T wouldn't have been feasible today because of our obsession with convenience, which I have a lot to say about later on. But what made it successful then, and still quintessential today, was how it was about maximum effect in a minimal package. And that's the third key point of quintessential design. But there were other things that made the car excellent. Model Ts were made of vanadium steel, which was an incredibly strong alloy which made the car durable. It could also comfortably seat four people, which was very rare for a car of its price at the time. While the design is pared down, the process that allowed for this car to be made so efficiently and cheaply is its absolutely maximalist supply chain and manufacturing process. The company's founder, Henry Ford, was obsessed with control. By 1920, he bought out all of the other shareholders, making him and a few of his family members the sole owner of one of the largest companies in the world. He controlled the entire empire. But his obsession with control didn't stop with corporate governance. It extended to the way his cars were built. Remember how I said the process of how an object is made is as important as the object itself? This is especially true with the Ford Model T. He started by pioneering the factory assembly line. Now, before, building a car was this really long process that took 12 or 13 hours to build a single car. Ford's assembly line changed all that, reducing the time to just 93 minutes. But Ford's drive for efficiency and control didn't just stop at the assembly line. As his empire grew, it became impossible to coordinate production and shipment so that each component and material would arrive at the right place and at the right time. Anytime he waited for parts or materials to arrive at his factory, he realized that he was wasting time. And time is money. So at first, he tried ordering an extra surplus of parts ahead of time and then storing them. But he quickly realized that was costly too. The storage warehouses were expensive, the parts could degrade, and transporting the materials to the manufacturing facility wasted time. So instead, his plan was to control every single aspect of the supply chain. He didn't want to rely on any other vendors or suppliers. He bought an entire railroad system so that he could quickly move all the components and materials across the production empire. He bought 700,000 acres of forest to harvest timber. He bought mines to extract ore near Lake Superior. He bought a fleet of Great Lakes freighter ships to transport this ore to his smelting plants to turn the ore into metal car components. He purchased 16 coal mines to power these factories and smelting facilities. He even bought a glass-making facility for the windshields. Ford had complete control over his entire manufacturing empire, from harvesting materials to production to assembly. It was complete vertical integration. It would then be manufactured and turned into a finished car on the Ford assembly lines. In only 28 hours, Ford's manufacturing empire could turn this into this. Isn't that f***ing crazy? Now, to be clear, this wasn't all good. It completely dehumanized the average worker. It's been said that Ford doubled the workers' wages at his factory and he shortened the workday to 8 hours a day. And that might sound good, but he only did this because his employees found the work insufferable and soul-crushing. Prior to raising these wages, it wasn't uncommon for employees to quit after only a few weeks. As if that wasn't bad enough, there was a point in time where every Ford Model T even came with an anti-Semitic newspaper called the Dearborn Independent. So yeah, Henry Ford wasn't exactly the best guy. But in spite of Henry Ford's questionable behavior, there's no doubt that the Model T completely changed culture, for better and for worse. Being able to move around whenever you wanted was pretty revolutionary. It even completely changed social dynamics. I mean, before the Model T, the way that men and women entered romantic relationships was a lot more formal. It was usually supervised by an adult chaperone who was present at all times. With the automobile, going out on dates without any supervision from parents became a much more common practice. Young people loved this freedom because, you know, they could get busy in the backseat of the car.
Where to, miss?
To the stars.
And many parents hated it and they called the car the devil wagon. But that's really just the beginning. Before the Model T, most people were limited to traveling distances that a horse could cover in a day, which was, you know, maybe 30 miles, give or take. If someone lived 50 miles away from you and not near a train route, they might as well have lived halfway across the world. I was talking to my friend Rafi about this, and he was saying that the Model T may have expanded our genetic and cultural diversity. You could get outside of your immediate social circle or local community and go to a place that's completely alien to you. People could meet and form relationships with others from different backgrounds, possibly enhancing the genetic robustness of the human species. Once again, it's just a hypothesis, but it's fun to think about. One thing that definitely is true is that the Model T literally defined American infrastructure and landscape, from traffic laws to city planning. Once Americans started using cars, there was a need to create a more robust paved road system. And with paved roads came suburbs. The Model T changed everything. Henry Ford's need for total control is what made him successful, but it's also what led to his downfall. Ford wanted to break the British monopoly on rubber by making his own rubber plantation in the middle of the Amazon. He called it Fordlandia. But the plantation was poorly managed, and rubber trees were devastated by pests because they were planted too close together. Plus, Ford tried to impose American customs on the Brazilian workers. He literally took a Midwestern town and just dropped it in the middle of the Amazon, thinking it would go fine. He forced Brazilian workers to have US diets of canned peaches and oatmeal. He even forced them to square dance, which is kind of like a weird flex. Alcohol was strictly forbidden, and he even built houses that looked just like homes you'd see in the Midwest, which were not suited to the Amazon. All sorts of creatures like bats and jaguars were getting into people's homes. It was a disaster. Ford would even force the workers to work an 8-hour shift through the hottest part of the day. Workers would often just pass out from heat exhaustion. Fordlandia was a massive failure, both financially and as a social experiment. Hundreds of workers perished from the heat, local wildlife, and diseases. Henry Ford had so much money that Fordlandia failing wasn't a big deal for him personally, but it was a major failure nonetheless. I will eventually do an entire video on people trying to design things for cultures they don't understand. It's gonna be a really good video, so be sure to subscribe so you're notified when I launch that video. But anyway, for 19 years, the Model T never really changed much because Ford was more concerned with offering the same car for cheaper rather than offering something better. Throughout the 1920s, General Motors was offering better cars in a range of colors and configurations, and the Model T really couldn't compete. Ford was about to go out of business, but they answered back with the Model A, which came as a sedan or a convertible in a wide variety of options. The Model A saved the company, but for better and for worse, it was the Model T that defined the cultural and geographical landscape of the United States. All said and done, Ford sold 15 million Model Ts over the course of about 19 years. It was the best-selling vehicle until 1972, when the Volkswagen Beetle surpassed it. The Model T is, without question, the most influential car of the 20th century, because of the car itself and because of what it represents, both good and bad. The key to achieving that influence as a quintessential design was in how it offered the maximum effect in a minimal package. Another key component of a quintessential design is whether it's indispensable. It needs to be an essential design that you would be lost without. It's even in the word, quintessential. The smartphone is the first thing billions of people look at within seconds of waking up every morning. It's hard to think of a more indispensable device. I think the iPhone is the most quintessential smartphone of them all. I know how cliche it is for another designer to be freaking out over Apple, but it's hard to think of many other devices that have reshaped cultural norms as profoundly as the iPhone. And for the record, before you accuse me of being an Apple fanboy, I've never owned an iPhone, and I haven't bought an Apple product in like 8 or 9 years. So why focus on the iPhone when the market is flooded with other brands? It really comes down to the fact that it became the blueprint for modern smartphone design. Before the iPhone, people were trying all sorts of different form factors. But once the iPhone came out, the big touchscreen with a single button at the bottom was the standard. Just look at how every manufacturer scrambled to mimic Apple's design after the iPhone came out. It's all about the touchscreen. Apple took the intuitive behavior of touch and made it a foundation of their interface. Losing the tactility of physical buttons was a gamble. Even the CEO of Microsoft predicted that the iPhone would fail because it didn't have a keyboard.
$500, fully subsidized with a plan? I said, that is the most expensive phone in the world, and it doesn't appeal to business customers because it doesn't have a keyboard.
Yeah, that clip aged like milk. I didn't buy my first smartphone until 2019, and transitioning from the T9 texting system, where each button click was really distinct, to tapping on this slippery glass screen was really hard for me. It felt like a cat trying to walk on ice. But eventually, I did figure it out, and so did about 5 billion other smartphone users. It's interesting to consider how much quintessential design is driven by users' behaviors and interactions. For example, imagine a computer without the computer mouse, or an iPod without the click wheel. In the same way, the iPhone's touchscreen transformed what was once an ordinary product into an indispensable design. Apple wasn't always the first to come up with these interfaces, but they often perfected them. Another thing that the iPhone tapped into was the need for convenience. This need for convenience is a larger macro trend you see across society and culture popping up constantly. The iPhone epitomizes this transition, simplifying complex interactions into simple taps and swipes. Food, entertainment, work, and even romantic relationships are contained in one single device. But this simplicity does mask complex underlying technologies that few understand and even fewer question. In other words, the technology makes decisions for us. The convenience comes at a cost. We're left consuming without understanding, and these devices designed to serve us slowly take over our ability to decide what we truly need. Have you ever noticed that almost every single social media app has a function where you can pull the screen down to refresh the feed? Now, when you do that, a new batch of content shows up. Sometimes what you see on the feed makes you angry, sometimes you like it, sometimes it's boring. No matter what, it's a little bit random, and that's very intentional. When things turn out the way we expect, the reward center in our brain stays dormant. But when something unexpected happens, those same reward centers in our brain absolutely light up. It's the same dopamine circuitry triggered by drug use and gambling. There really isn't a big difference between pulling a lever down on a slot machine versus pulling the screen down on your smartphone to refresh the feed. The smartphone exploits those same reward systems. Steve Jobs referred to the computer as a bicycle for the mind, but lately, smartphones feel more like a slot machine for our psyche. It's not uncommon for us to check our phones and swipe up on the feed 85 times a day. The smartphone really sets the standard for what a quintessential design can achieve when it aligns perfectly with larger cultural shifts and habits. It's why the smartphone and all of its apps are more than indispensable. They're addictive. So I know that things are getting a little bit negative here. I mean, complaining about the perils of technology really isn't anything new. It goes all the way back to the printing press. And more recently, in my own lifetime, there's been a fuss about video game violence, excessive TV watching, and how overly sexual music lyrics are shredding the moral fabrics of society.
Won't somebody please think of the children?
Most of these concerns turn out to be nothing, or at the very least, overblown. I mean, I grew up with all those things, and look at me, I turned out perfectly fine. But I also think it's important to talk about how the smartphone has both positive and negative implications. Let's talk about some good things, though. I was talking to my friend Mark, who bought the first iPhone. He was saying that when the iPhone came out, it felt like a piece of alien technology, and it still kind of does. It fits perfectly in the hand with its generously curved edges, and everything about this design just makes you want to reach out and grab it. The chrome bezel around the screen draws your eye into the display nicely. This black plastic piece on the bottom not only creates a nice visual contrast that breaks up the form to make it feel less blocky, but the plastic also offers a warmer, grippier surface for your palm. Even though the iPhone is mostly celebrated for the groundbreaking touchscreen, it's still a very tactile device in terms of materials, form, and finish. My main criticism is with the headphone jack at the top. It goes really deep into the phone. It looks very out of place. But besides that, this design really is well done. Apple's commitment to exceptional design quality goes way beyond just usability and aesthetics. It's a testament to their formidable scale and negotiating power with manufacturers. To achieve the high standards of quality of the iPhone, a company has to order millions of units so they have bargaining power with the manufacturer. When you're dangling hundreds of millions of dollars over your manufacturer's heads, you can more easily insist on precise manufacturing tolerances and flawless fit and finish. Even after nearly 20 years, the manufacturing quality of this iPhone is better than most consumer electronics available today. And that's because the manufacturers know that meeting Apple's exacting standards is challenging, but the massive order volumes make it worth it. Just like the Ford Model T we talked about earlier, Apple's ability to push manufacturers to their limits, set new industry standards, and showcase the incredible results that can be achieved through the power of large-scale production. The beauty of this device is the first thing that draws us in, but the interaction is what keeps us hooked. The smartphone has become the mediator in literally every aspect of our lives, from food to relationships to entertainment. No device has ever been so all-consuming and indispensable. Convenience has been a priority for decades. Things like microwaves, instant coffee, and vacuum cleaners marked the first convenience revolution. It was about making life easier for you. The second convenience revolution, marked by the iPhone and social media, made it easier to be you. These technologies were convenient means of self-expression. According to Steve Jobs in 1998, the I in iMac and later iPod and iPhone stands for Internet. Individual, instruct, inform, and inspire. While that may have been the initial meaning, it's pretty obvious that the I stands for I, as in me. It's all about you as the individual. Another thing that makes the smartphone indispensable is how it democratized the spread of information. In several countries, particularly ones in Africa and South Asia, a significant portion of the population accesses the internet entirely through smartphones. Now, to be fair, most of them are not using an expensive iPhone, but they're probably using a design heavily based on it. The smartphone can be used for good things like education or for bad things like misinformation and propaganda campaigns. But the democratization of information is undeniable. Looking forward, we're not just in need of smarter phones. We need phones with better social skills. What we need is a more polite and quiet device. It's almost like the smartphone has become too indispensable, and we need to take a step back. Right now, several new tech companies are trying to create a more healthy interface with the digital world. The Rabbit R1, the Daylight Computer, and the Humane AI Pin are all trying to create a viable alternative to the all-consuming smartphone. Whether they're successful or not depends on their ability to maintain the indispensable convenience of a smartphone while also giving users more control over their lives. The true innovation in future technologies will not be measured by the speed of processors or the display resolution of screens, but by how well they harmonize with the rhythms of our human needs and social conventions. The ultimate goal is to create a more thoughtful digital environment with more depth. Whoever figures this out will usher in the next revolution in quintessential computing. So we've talked about some things that make a design quintessential. It needs to have these features. But there's another element that we haven't really discussed at all. To understand it, we need to look at the origin of the word quintessential. Quintessence is a term borrowed from ancient philosophy, originally referred to as the fifth element. Quint means five. Earth, wind, water, and fire are the first four elements. Ether is the fifth element. It's an invisible ingredient believed to fill the universe beyond the four tangible elements. Now, modern science has moved beyond the concept of the ether, but the metaphor survives in our language as a way to describe the purest and most essential part of something. I was talking to my friend Rafi about this, and he was saying that it's poetic how we use the word quintessential. It's a word rooted in the elusive and the intangible, but we use it to describe very tangible, concrete objects of enduring value. Quintessential design is about tapping into an emotional resonance that hits us on an almost instinctual level. It's how a simple paperclip, a flashlight, or a phone becomes an indispensable part of our lives in a way that's hard to describe. In the same way that ancient philosophers and scientists never found the fifth element, the fifth element in design is also kind of a mystery. Designing things is hard. But designing truly great things feels almost impossible. This is going to sound extremely cheesy, but maybe love for what we create is the quintessential fifth element of design. Sounds even worse when I say it out loud. But I think it's true. None of these designs would have existed if their creators didn't really care about what they were making. Quintessential designs are this lucky blend of creativity, empathy, and timing. They're an almost magical combination of factors that can't be controlled or predicted. These quintessential objects remind us that not everything in our increasingly deterministic world can be reduced to predictable formulas. Here's to the designers, engineers, and dreamers who remind us that within every creation lies the potential for magic, a reminder that the air we breathe while creating today's wonders could be tomorrow's quintessence. I hope you enjoyed this video, everyone. Don't forget to subscribe below. Consider supporting me on Patreon if you like these videos. Also, I'm writing a book with my friend Rafi Manassian. We're currently on the 7th draft and we'll be publishing it soon. Click the link in the description below to sign up and get notified when it releases. Thanks, everyone, and have a great day.